Council, good morning to you. This is the case of McGill Restoration, Inc. versus Lime Place Condominium Association. And we will begin today by introductions from members of the court. I'm Mike Havigan, the Chief Justice, and now by order of seniority as to service on the court, the other members of the court will introduce themselves.
Good morning, William Castle.
Stephanie Stacy, good morning.
Good morning, Jeff Funk.
Jonathan Pappett.
And John Freidenberg.
I should note Justice Miller Lerman, who has been participating earlier by WebEx, is recused from this matter. And counsel, Mr. Becker, you're here with us today. And Ms. McGill, you are with us today.
Yes, sir.
Good morning to both of you. Counsel, when you're at counsel table, we would appreciate it if you wear your mask. But when you are presenting to the court, please take your mask off so that we can hear and understand what you have to say. Do you have any questions before we begin? No questions. Mr. Becker, then, good morning to you again, and you may approach and you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court, Ted Becker on behalf of the Lime Place Condominium Association. Our arguments on appeal are set forth in the brief, and I'll go in somewhat of reverse order in terms of items that I think are easily addressed. I was not trial counsel. I'm just counsel on appeal. I had represented one of the Lime Place Association owners, Michael Henry, who had been dismissed individually, and then have taken over on appeal for the association. I think clearly this case is not one that was legally frivolous in terms of the defense. Trial counsel may have been unsuccessful adducing some of its evidence that it wanted to get in to defend the claim, but this in no way, shape, or form was a legally frivolous defense of a claim. Unquestionably, this contractor was hired to perform work at the building.
Why did the district court feel it was frivolous?
He references the fact that the association should have known it couldn't have won without an expert. But there is no Nebraska case that says that unequivocally. The cases that are cited by McGill Restoration, if you look at them closely, involve largely negligence. One of the cases, the Storjohn case, involved a reference to objective versus subjective medical diagnosis, and in that context, a personal injury case needing expert testimony. And even then, the court said, left open the notion that on objective injuries, you may not need it, but in subjective cases, you won't. It's apples to oranges to this. You have a building that literally there are pictures of the work that was done flaking away and falling away. You have contractors whose testimony was excluded, but they gave bids to remedy this contractor's work. And within their bids, noted observations of why that work may have failed, including not allowing sufficient time to cure, the weather, et cetera.
Is there anything in our record that shows anything tying those bids to the work that was actually done by Mr. McGill?
If you look in the bids, you look in our brief, I cited some references where they talk about the work done and why it was failing. They were brought out there to come look at the failing work, and they're redoing the failing work. Now, are their bids more encompassing than the McGill, because one of the contractors is going to redo the whole building in effect? But within his bid, he talks about his observation of why it may have failed and what's necessary to correct that failure.
Didn't they actually state in questioning or through affidavit? I can't remember at what point it was in the record, but that they did not have an opinion on the workmanlike performance of McGill?
They gave affidavits that were, we are not going to render an opinion that the work was deficient in quantity. But that's like going to another doctor and saying, are you going to testify that Surgeon Smith committed malpractice? As opposed to if you had a patient going and see that doctor for a second opinion, and within the visit to that doctor says, I wouldn't have done it the way Surgeon Smith done it. You have an injury. This is how we fix it. And then when they're confronted to testify, they back off. But that doesn't mean that the defense is frivolous or that that testimony of the treating physician in my analogy should be excluded. Here you have contractors.
And our standard of review is abuse of discretion.
And I think it, well, I think you can make that determination as a matter of law. But even if you look at it from the abuse of perspective prism, I still think it's an abuse of discretion. Even here's an example. One of the cases they cite, the Gleason versus Hendrickson case, where they suggest that there is expert testimony needed for a tradesman. In that case, it was a county court case, and the guy that was making the claimant on a paint job that was some defective panels had bad paint. His expert testimony was his brother that worked in a paint store who did some painting on cars, and the court found that sufficient. Here we have contractors coming in proposing to redo the work, and I submit that that evidence should have been brought in. In addition, it's in this context, it was a trial to the bench. It's not as if you're trying it to the jury and you could inflame prejudices, or you couldn't have a fact finder that might be able to segregate some of the more extraneous information. Bottom line is, I don't think this is not a frivolous defense. The trial counsel may have failed in what they wanted to do, but it was not frivolous. It's also not frivolous because if you look at the letter that the owner of McGill Restoration sent, he acknowledges that the product failed. He says, we're going to come do the warranty work if you pay us in full. You do
warranty. Is that the evidence the court excluded because it determined part of a settlement negotiation?
Yes, because he mouths the words at the beginning of an opening paragraph that suggests, well, in an effort to compromise this dispute, I'll come look at it. But within the body, he says, there's obviously a failure. I'm going to bring out the manufacturer to try to figure out why there's a failure. If you pay us, we're going to warranty the work and redo it. This is unlike
the sorts of things that people say during settlement negotiations.
I respectfully disagree. You don't typically say my work failed, that I'm going to bring out a manufacturer's rep to figure out why it failed so that we can do it right. The unpublished court appeals case is more of a classic example of offers of compromise where the other side says, well, we think your numbers are off, but we're going to offer to pay you this. That's the case that they cite as an analogy to exclude on an offer of compromise. That had to deal with numbers. This had to come out and look at their own work. And keep in mind, this person's testifying, we did our work in a good workmanlike manner. Why could not trial counsel impeach him by saying, you did your work in a good and workmanlike manner? Why did you wait 2 years to sue him? And why, when you went out there, did you note that the product was failing? Why did you note that you were going to bring out the manufacturer to try to figure out why it failed? I submit that
review of frivolity, something like our review of credibility that a trial court judge makes, that the judge has seen and heard the witnesses and so forth. Is that a similar kind of review in regard to frivolity?
I respectfully do not believe so, Your Honor. And I think a number of cases have rejected and concluded, hey, cases are not frivolous because it's such an extreme standard. If you apply that extreme standard, there is no way, shape, or form that the defense of this was frivolous. I think the court may have been frustrated with the way trial counsel handled it, but that doesn't mean it's frivolous. If it was frivolous, why didn't he pierce through the evidence and grant summary judgment? Because the evidence was the same. If it was such a legally frivolous defense, why didn't he grant summary judgment? It's because there were fact issues. And the fact that there's fact issues, that you have the owner saying, I paid to have this work done and it's not being done. My analogy is, I don't have to be an expert roofer to know that if I hire a roofer and he redoes my roof and then there's a leak, I think I can rightfully question paying that guy in full, even though I don't know how to install a roof or take a roof off or what's entailed in the process, if it's not performing its function. In this case, there are pictures showing cracking, flaking, chunks falling down. So I respectfully submit that it was at a minimum abuse of discretion to exclude the evidence where there's an admission. It's not a frivolous defense. I would also point out, there is no appropriate waiver of the jury trial by the association. And the association's request for a jury trial in this case should have been sustained.
Did the appellant's attorney at that time have authority to make a waiver without the client?
He did not. That is clear in the record. Then he admits in his affidavit he didn't have authority to do that.
I'm sorry.
Please go ahead.
I was going to say, should a trial judge have to look behind a counsel standing right in front of the judge and saying, "We'll go with the bench trial, Your Honor"? Should the judge have to say, "Do you have authority to waive a jury trial?" That's really what you're arguing.
And I think that's what's required by the statute. I just had.
Have we ever said that in interpreting that statute?
I just had district court this week where we're on the phone. We set a bench trial. And Judge Korslund, who was covering it, said, "Counsel, I want you, if you're going to waive trial, submit a written waiver." Very simple. You know, we both declared we're going to waive it. He tells us to submit a written waiver.
Exactly. There's, to be sure, is it required?
I believe it is to meet the statute because.
I don't think you ever answered Judge Stacy's question. Have we ever said that?
I don't know that you've ever said that. The statute says oral consent in open court entered on a journal, and that's not present. Telling a bailiff, "Yes, we'll schedule it for a bench trial in March," is not a declaration in open court entered on the journal. It's not a judge saying, "Counsel, are you waiving jury trial?" And
say, "Bench trial, right?" And the lawyers said, "Yes."
That is not a waiver. That was in the context of the replacement counsel coming in, and he explains later at the motion, "Hey, all I'm looking at is my understanding of the scheduling of it." He knew nothing about the concept of there being a waiver or had there been a waiver. He's just acknowledging the date that he knows, yes, it's scheduled for a bench trial. That's all that second counsel's doing when he comes in, because that's the second counsel, Maxwell. The one who purportedly waived it's Kennedy. And Kennedy says, "I don't have authority." Kennedy never does it on the record. Maxwell never does it on the record beyond saying, "Oh, yes, it's scheduled for March 15th or 16th. I respectfully submit that doesn't meet the statute. And especially when you're talking about a constitutional right like waiver of a jury trial, that shouldn't be enough. And now's an opportunity for the court to say it. Here's the process to do it. Because it's an important right, because we have a statute that has certain requirements, meet those requirements. The statute language is clear. There's three ways to do it. It wasn't done in this case. It may slide by sometimes, but if you're going to do it, then set a standard that says you got to have clear and unequivocal waiver of the right to a jury trial. I see my time's up. If there's any other questions, otherwise.
Thank you very much. Ms. McGill, good morning to you.
May it please the court, opposing counsel.
You may remove your mask.
Thank you. I forgot. I'm so used to it.
Presenting.
I'm Jody McGill. I'm the representative for McGill Restoration. And I think it's important to think about the facts in this case. It was John Adams who said, "Facts are stubborn things, and whatever may be our wishes, our inclinations, or the dictates of our passion, they cannot alter the state of facts and evidence." And the appellant is stuck with the facts of the underlying case and the facts of what actually happened at trial. He talks about the waiver of jury trial, and something I omitted in my brief, I guess I wanted the opportunity to say it in oral arguments, was that the counsel of record also waived its right to a jury trial when it asked for a directed verdict and did not do that with reservation. That, this court has said, is sufficient. It's an act that qualifies as waiving a jury trial. I also believe that when, like Honor Stacy said, the court asked, "Is this to a bench trial?" And both myself and the counsel at the time affirmatively said, "Yes, it is," that is also sufficient to waive the jury trial. So I think they did meet the statute. I think that there was harmless error done by the judge in his reasoning as to how the jury trial was waived, because continuously he said it was when the counsel asked the bailiff to remove it from the jury panel date. I agree. I submit that is not sufficient, but that combined with these other actions does qualify. It meets the standard. It meets what this court has said is sufficient to waive that jury trial. The appellant keeps talking about the the frivolousness of the action, how the court found that this is a frivolous matter. But they keep talking about it only in regards to their defense. And I think that is way misleading because they actually filed a counterclaim in this action. And that was the reason why we had to use expert testimony and why they had to rebut that expert testimony. It's the standard that if we present evidence and make a prima facie case, we present what the workmanlike conditions are, they have to rebut that. And they failed to do that. They presented three witnesses who they wanted to testify, two of which were contractors who were not asked to give opinions. They were not provided the facts to form opinions. And they gave an affidavit swearing to that, that they didn't have any opinions contrary to McGill Restoration, they didn't have any opinions contrary to the work that McGill Restoration did on the building. They didn't have enough information to even formulate opinions. None of their witnesses could testify about the scope of work that was done. And I think that's important because continuously they're talking about during the trial, concrete falling off. And that was brought in the brief as well. Arguments that concrete falling off the building. They didn't specify what side of the building, because that's important too, because McGill Restoration's work was not encompassing the whole building. It was on one side of the building and they didn't use concrete. And that is part of the testimony of Mr. McGill, is that concrete was not something that they were working with. It was not a material that they used. So these facts again are very important because they bring in people who are not familiar with the work that was done and they want to give opinions, but those opinions are not based in reason. The two people who were familiar with the scope of work are Mr. McGill, who testified, and Mr. Rabick, who also testified. And they both said, yes, we entered into this contract. Yes, the work was done appropriately and believe that McGill Restoration should be paid for that work, and no payment was made. They want to bring up that the facts that 2 years went by before we filed a lawsuit. But during those 2 years, they neglect to mention that there was no complaints made about McGill Restoration's work. It was a collection action. That's really how it was filed, is just a collection of a bill that never got paid. And that's how it proceeded until they filed a counterclaim alleging that McGill Restoration failed to meet the standard. And they actually claimed that McGill Restoration did harm to the building, which again, they brought no witnesses, no experts to testify to the damages that they were alleging.
Did McGill specifically warranty that its repairs would not fail for any reason? Was that ever part of the agreement?
No, there was no written agreement. So there was no warranty provided. And that goes to the settlement negotiations. And I think the court was correct in finding that that letter should not come in. It meets all the standards of a settlement negotiation. The reasons behind settlement are to try to get the case completed and really to have peace. And that is why we don't allow those kind of conversations to come in. They want to make an argument about the basis of that, but it was clearly a settlement negotiation letter. That's what the court found, and all the facts support that.
Counsel, we have frequently said that when we're considering a request for attorney fees under 25824 and the related sections, that we view that with great skepticism, I think is a fair way of characterizing that. That would be a paraphrase, not a quotation, but we give the reasonable doubt to the advocate who's asserting a position. In other words, it has to be pretty clear before you can have an attorney fee award under 25824. What is it about the facts here that makes it so clear as to justify the attorney fee award?
I think the basis of they had knowledge of what our expert was going to say, because we did file a summary judgment wherein we laid it all out for them, what the standard was, what our expert was going to say, and what they had to do to controvert that. And yet they proceeded to trial without an actual expert. The only person that testified really on their behalf was Mr. Henry, and the court held that whether or not he was an expert until he actually testified. So they gave him the benefit of the doubt on that. And when he did testify, he said he had worked in the construction industry for 20 some years or number of years. He mixed concrete one time, and therefore he is an expert again on concrete.
Well, which Mr. Decker makes the argument that if this case was so frivolous, why didn't the judge dispose of it at summary judgment?
I think the judge was trying to give them an opportunity to present. He didn't look into the credentials of Mr. Henry and was going to allow him the opportunity to prove himself as an expert. I think the court could have awarded a summary judgment, but just because the court did not award a summary judgment certainly does not go to whether or not the case was frivolous. And again, it had well, the
when,
ability.
When a court finds that summary judgment's inappropriate, isn't it by definition finding there are material issues of fact that are genuinely disputed?
I think they, based on what the court was presented at the time of summary judgment, it was not sufficient for the court to find that there were no material questions of fact.
Are the claimed fees for all of the contesting of the counterclaim, in other words, both before and after summary judgment?
It's for the judge ruled on a date. It was for the counterclaim, but I think the court made it clear it was not for the prosecution of the case. So again, the court, the appellant was allowed to present defense, but pursuing on the counterclaim, knowing that they had no expert to present evidence about what the standard was, or that McGill failed to meet that standard, really is what changed.
So it did or did not include fees for the attempt to obtain summary judgment?
I guess I don't remember the date and how the dates all lined up, so I can't speak to that offhand.
So you would agree, would you not, that something that starts off that may not be frivolous can become frivolous during the course of proceedings?
Absolutely.
And so that date has some importance.
The date on which the judge ordered attorney right. fees to back from. I do. I wish I would have looked into that further, but I don't have any recollection as to the importance of that date right now as to why the judge picked that. I will note that there were a number of hours, and I explained to the court at the time when I asked for attorney's fees, there was a number of hours I did not attribute to the defense of the counterclaim, and so I didn't even ask for those. And the amount was quite small. This case went on for, it's been going on for 10 years. And I was awarded $5,000 in fees. So that in itself, I think, is sufficient to show that there wasn't, it wasn't all encompassing of the prosecution of this case. And the defendants needed to do what they needed to do to make a prima facie case.
So what amount was requested in the motion?
I don't remember.
More than 5,000.
It was more than 5,000. It was sufficiently more. It might have been 15, maybe.
Thank you.
Any more questions? I think once the court reviews the facts of the case and the argument, they will agree that the court was correct in its finding and affirm the decision. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal? Thank you. There is no time for rebuttal. Counsel, you are excused, and this was the final case of the day, so the court is adjourned. As you leave today, please leave by the side door, and if you can, properly social distance and mask, that would be greatly appreciated. And again, thank you very much.